Okay, we're going to go ahead and get started. I hope to get through all of this. Sometimes I talk more than I need to talk, or say more than I ought to say, and then I run out of time. But we'll go ahead and get started with a word of prayer and then get right into it. Lord Jesus, we thank you for this day and for allowing us to have this time to look at these principles and some things that will be a help to us. I pray that you would bless it. We thank you for just the opportunity of living today, being here at your house, being with your people, and hearing your word. In Jesus' name, amen. Okay, managing the stress of life. I do want to mention to you, first of all, this is not exhaustive. I can't cover everything in this short time that we have together. I basically picked out three different areas to talk about as far as stress is concerned. That would be like in relationships and our finances and especially in our time and our schedules. So those would be the things that we stress a little bit later, but I wanted to start with a couple of definitions of stress. One says that stress is response. It's the physical, mental, and emotional adjustments we make to circumstances of our lives. Now, that can be whether they're good circumstances or bad, but we are making an adjustment to them, whatever they are. A second definition simply refers to stress as life changes. This is the one that I like the best, or at least easier for me to understand. Life changes that are good or bad that affect us in some way, because we all have stress in our lives. Surprisingly, people don't realize that there are two kinds of stress. That stress can be positive and negative. Negative is what we usually refer to when we say, oh, I'm really stressed out, that kind of thing. But positive stress, first of all, is called eustress. I was an English teacher, so I'm real big on prefixes and suffixes and those kinds of things. But eu is a prefix that means good or well. So basically, this is saying good stress. And this includes things like getting a promotion at work, or getting a raise, getting married, having a baby, buying your house, going to college, all those things that we consider good, retirement. We consider those good things in our lives, but we also have to make a physical, mental, and emotional adjustment to those things. Sometimes this kind of stress can motivate us to do things that maybe we ordinarily wouldn't do or are not comfortable with, like public speaking, for instance, or going for an interview and being really nervous about that. But this good stress gets us through that, or on a first date. Now, it's probably been a long time since any of us were on first dates, but you understand what I mean. That's stressful, you know, worrying about those kinds of things. So the good stress gets us through that. Negative stress, on the other hand, is called distress. That's how we say the word, but the prefix is di in front of stress. Di means two or double. So obviously this would be double the stress of what we would consider something good. So eustress, generally considered positive. Distress is not. It's usually associated with those things that are negative. It's harmful to our well-being, and it's very difficult to live with when we feel like we're under a lot of stress all the time. One author described it as a fearful concern that we experience when life's demands seem greater than our ability to meet them. These would be things in our schedule, for instance, or where we've taken on more than we should, or we've got so many things to get to, we feel like we're just running around here and there, and we're not quite sure, we can't even think straight. This can also be in our relationships. People can have problems with their spouses, in their marriages, or problems with children, or problems with in-laws. That seems to be common a lot. Sometimes they have problems with their bosses. Children will have problems with their teachers in school, or college students may have that. So that's in that area where we'd have negative stress. Could be during a spiritual battle where we're really fighting something. Could be because of our own decisions that we find ourselves in a stressful situation, or it could be something completely outside our control. For instance, a child who's raised in a difficult home, or where there's abuse and those kinds of things involved. A lot of stress there, but that's nothing that the child did to create that. That was out of his control. We can categorize the stress as either internal or external. And this isn't rocket science, but it's either in ourselves and our own thinking, and we are stressed about something, or it's external based upon what somebody else did or said. And one other thing I want to mention is it shows up differently for all of us. We don't all experience stress to the same degree, ever. Okay, what really might stress me wouldn't stress Debbie at all. Okay, and vice versa, those kinds of things. I wanted to take a few minutes as well and talk about how negative stress affects us. In general, it affects us in three ways: physically, mentally, and emotionally. Physically, you may have even heard doctors say, you know, you need to slow down and get the stress out of your life or whatever. Your blood pressure is too high. You might start having chest pains or dizziness. Some people have a lot of stomach upset or intestinal issues, that kind of thing. Headaches, fatigue, general body aches, sleep problems, and so forth. Those are physical effects of negative stress. I attached to your sheet at the end, or at the back, this little life change index scale. And I would say over the last 50 years, I haven't seen this change very much. It's almost exactly as it was 50 years ago, except I noticed that they added jail term up there. That was not on there before. But that is up there now. But death of spouse is still the highest on the list. Causes people the greatest stress in their lives. And divorce is right under that. And I always tell people that's because divorce is the death of a marriage, basically. So it's a very difficult thing to go through. So a lot of that is there. You've got personal illness or injury up there at the top. Marriage is up there. Now, again, marriage is a positive thing. But remember, that's a positive stress. And you just have to make a lot of adjustments in life when you're married. So it's still up there pretty high. Retirement's on there as well. So I understand that a little bit. And I'm sure some of you do, too. You know, you think, yes, I don't have to go to work every day, and this is going to be great. And then all of a sudden, you find yourself like, well, what am I going to do today? You know, those kinds of things. So it's a little difficult sometimes to make those adjustments. And I was thinking they had up there, oh, yes, they do, right under jail term, they have death of a close family member. So I know that there have been people, even in this church, who have lost children. And very stressful. But basically this thing, and you can look at this on your own, they kind of give you directions about how you can do this. And again, this is just a general thing. That doesn't mean that you're going to fall into this. But if you look at those things and give yourself your points over there, like in the last year, well, let's not do pregnancy. Probably haven't been too many of those in this room. But marriage, Johnny's been married in the last year. You know, and maybe some of you retired in the last year or whatever, or you've lost a close family member. I know that's also occurred, but you put those points over there, and this is within the last year. It's either happened or you know it's going to happen here within a short period of time. And then you can kind of look over here and see, oh, I've got this many life change units and the likelihood of perhaps having an illness in the future just because of that. Okay, I need to move along. Emotionally, an extremely stressed person can become depressed. He can feel alone, like, you know, nobody else has gone through this. This is just me. Nobody's as busy as I am. Nobody hurts like I hurt. Become very unhappy, completely overwhelmed with the situation. Again, in a schedule where he's got too much to do and feel like I cannot possibly get all this done today. Maybe his marriage is falling apart and he's, you know, I've done everything I know to do. I don't know what else to do. So that stresses him. Bills are more than the paychecks. That happens a lot. At least it seems to. Other signs of emotional stress might be that a generally once stable person all of a sudden doesn't seem like he's as stable as he was. In other words, he's not quite as laid back. He's easily agitated or irritated by situations. Maybe to the point of anger, becoming very anxious and moody and so forth. Mentally, and I've already mentioned this, but a person can be so stressed that he can't think straight. I don't know if you've ever been there, but I have, especially in a teaching situation, because when you teach, you don't just teach classroom. You have a lot of things outside the classroom you have to do. And when you're doing that, and then, you know, you're trying to help your husband at home on a farm, and then you've got all these extracurricular activities, and you've got four children, and it just, you know, I don't know what I'm supposed to do next. I mean, seriously, I've been there thinking, what am I supposed to do next? I can't concentrate, can't remember things, use poor judgment. Sometimes people will think very negatively about everything. It's like, nothing's right. They can't figure out who to pin all that on, but just think very negatively, constantly worrying. It's also not unusual for people that are mentally stressed like this to experience anxiety and panic attacks. They're very common. And all of this happens because stress is one of those things. The negative stress steals our joy. It weighs down heavy on it. It affects our relationship. And we got to figure out, what are we going to do? Unfortunately, a lot of people, and even Christian people, will do things like turn to pills or drugs or alcohol. Some get heavily involved in sexual relationships, might sleep too much or not at all. A lot of people turn to food, a lot of binge eating. I've heard people say that often, you know, I'm stress eating today. I think I've been there a few times too. But, you know, they're just, give me food, because food is a type of comfort, and hoping that that's going to kind of relieve some of that stress or whatever. Other people may just procrastinate and put everything off or neglect their responsibilities completely, or maybe even withdraw from people completely and just try to get out by themselves. So I think the question that I put on your sheet next was, so as God's children, can we experience a stressless life and know God's rest and peace in the midst of our hectic lives and unwelcome circumstances? Can we do that? I think that the Bible teaches us that we can. So I want to look, first of all, at Matthew 11:28. This is one of my favorite verses. It says, "Come unto me, all ye who labor and heavy laden, and I will give you rest." Now, I'm also one of those people that I don't like to just pick and choose verses out of the Bible to support my particular agenda, whatever that might be, or what my point I'm trying to make to people. So I wanted to look at this, first of all, in context. Why did Jesus say this, and who did he say it to? He was speaking to the Jews at that particular time. And you'll remember that the Jews were trying so hard to keep the law, and this law was, I don't know, 600 and some principles or something they had to keep. They could not possibly do all of that. It was too much. But they were trying, and all the time they're failing. And basically, Jesus said, hey, I came to take care of that. That's why God sent me. Just come to me, and I'll take care of it, because what you're doing isn't effective anyway. So I think that's what the context of that verse is. But I also think that we can infer some meaning for us today in that as well. The Greek word for rest is anapeo, and it's twofold. The meaning is twofold. It does refer to spiritual refreshment, but it also means to cause a person to cease from any work in order to recover and collect his strength. That means he's going to rest from working. So he becomes physically refreshed, and he can become spiritually refreshed. It's the same word that Jesus used in Mark 6:31 when he said to his disciples, "Come yourselves apart into the desert place and rest a while." The disciples had been out on their mission. It went some of their missionary trips that Jesus had sent them out on. If you'll look later in that verse, it says there were many coming and going. They had no leisure so much as to eat, meaning that the disciples were so busy ministering to people, even as they came home at this point and were coming back to Jesus, some people were still following after them, wanting to learn from them and seeking answers about life and so forth. They really didn't eat like they should have eaten, and they didn't rest the way they should have eaten, or should have rested, meaning just rest, get away from it all and take a break. And I think Jesus recognized that he needed that, or he recognized that they had a need for both physical and spiritual rest. I probably, as I looked at that verse again, the Matthew 11:28, I kind of paraphrased it this way. Jesus said, "Come unto me, all of you who are physically and spiritually tired and exhausted and stressed out and hurting and burdened, all of you people, come to me and I will give you rest." So we're going to take a few minutes now and look at some ways, some practical ways that we can eliminate stress from our lives and experience this peace and rest of God as he intended. And again, I can't cover everything, but we're going to do three. And the first one is in our schedules. And the first point under there is to prioritize the important. Now, when I look at verses like Matthew 6:33 and Luke 10:37, this is "Seek ye first the kingdom of God," that verse, and then where it tells us in Luke and other places to love the Lord our God with all our heart, soul, mind, and strength, those kinds of things, that tells me our first priority as believers is to God. Our first priority is always to God. If we are married, the second is to our spouse. Third would be to our family, followed by our job and ministry. So for me, when I'm looking at things and I'm trying to prioritize what is important, I have to keep those things in mind. Those are the most important of everything. Of course, we have jobs. You know, we have responsibilities at those jobs and so forth. And I hope maybe this will make some of that clear to you, at least be helpful. So some of these subpoints may overlap. That's okay. But the first subpoint is we need to take inventory of all our responsibilities. What do I have to do today? Or what do I have to do this week? Or what do I have to get accomplished by the end of the month? Teachers do this a lot, okay? Because every day you walk into a classroom, it's like, okay, I've got to get this done today. And I suppose maybe even mothers do that if they're really organized. I don't know. Today, this has to be done at the house. I'm not sure, but we have to take inventory and then ask ourselves, how important is this thing? I have all of these things to do. How important is each one of them? And then and number two, or the second subpoint there, is to evaluate personal limits and then organize our days or weeks accordingly. Evaluate personal limits and then organize our days and weeks accordingly. Now, what that means is by evaluating personal limits, first of all, that would be your ability to do a specific job. I mean, can you do this job? Or do you take on something you really can't do or you know nothing about? That's not smart for any of us. That falls into that category, your family commitments. If you've promised your wife or your husband or your children that you're going to do something, or Friday night is always going to be family night or something like that, then you can't go along and say, yeah, I can stay 5 hours after work and do such and such, after you've already promised your family you would do something else. Those are personal limits. Even taking time for lunch, or taking time for exercise in your day, just it's having a good balance, and you have to know what that is. We can't go around all day long putting out fires. And by what I mean by that is, let's just say you work in an office and you're sitting at your desk and you have this list of things you have to do in order of importance, and then somebody comes in and says, oh, the copier is broken. I don't know how to fix it. Do you know how to do it? Yeah, I know how to do it. So get up, go out there, you know, and you work on a copier. Now you've taken away from your important things to go do something urgent. Urgent things are always going to come up, always come up with children, especially. They're always going to have urgent things come up in a day. So we can't do that all day long if we take care of all the urgent things and the important things don't get taken care of. That's my point. So we have to determine what the important things are, then build your schedule around them. And you can always leave a little margin in your schedule. Now, I don't know any of you. I'm not like this, but I know people who are. I call them workaholics. They're type A personalities, and the busier they are, the better they like it. And they're just rushing here and rushing there doing stuff. That's not me. I have no problem sitting down and resting. But some people are like that. They don't leave any margin in their schedule. Well, if you don't leave any margin in the schedule, you schedule it all up this way, then what do you do if something unexpected comes up? So that's the point. Prioritize the important things and then stick to that as much as possible with that little bit of margin there and in there for anything extra, and that'll help eliminate that hurry and the stress to try to get it all done. The third subpoint there is don't overlook taking care of yourself. That also is very important. That means you eat right. You get some exercise in, get enough sleep. Now, by exercise, I don't mean we're going to go out and do P90X or something like that. If any of you know what that is, that would kill me. I mean, that would kill me for sure. But, you know, you can go out for a walk and, you know, walk a little bit, walk a mile, walk a half mile, walk anywhere. It doesn't matter, but just get some kind of exercise in. That helps to a little bit with stress because it siphons off some of the adrenaline and those kind of things. It has us all hyped up all the time. So it helps with that. And, of course, getting enough sleep. I think I find that increasingly difficult as I get older, and I have no idea why, but I hear that a lot from people. But we do have to get enough sleep. And that means, like, if you're working a job, you can't burn the candle at both ends. You know, stay up really late trying to do something and get up really early and start all over again, because eventually that's going to take a toll on you. And I'll just mention this because it's extra, and I always just like to tell this story. But when I was in junior high, I worked with my grandpa on his dairy farm. I was pretty good at what I did. I mean, I was only in junior high. I felt like I was strong, you know, and I could help him bale hay and drive the tractor and do all of these kinds of things. But he hired this boy from up the street who was in high school, so he was several years older than me. He would show up to work on a day, and I kid you not, he had a Coke in his hand and two Twinkies in his hand, and he was going to work on that. Now, you and I both know that's not going to last long because the sugar is going to be poof gone, and he's going to, oh, I can't work anymore. But that's what happens. That's why the eating right is important for us as well. And then this maybe overlaps a little bit, but I also consider taking care of yourself to include scheduling family time, leisure time, dates with your spouse, those kinds of things. So you have time away from the hustle and bustle to recharge. I also wrote down in my notes, it's not helpful to do that if you take your work with you. Okay, you take your work with you, you know, you take your laptop and I got to check this, or are you on your phone, you know, you got to have a conference call. It's just this one call, you know, but I got, this is important. But then you've taken away from the whole idea of we need to get this time, have this time, have it away and devote it to our family, to ourselves and so forth. I just a couple weeks ago, a friend of mine posted on Facebook this little meme thing, and the meme said this: if you don't make time for your wellness, you'll be forced to make time for your illness. And what she said for herself was this: you don't have to be all, support all, go to all, give all, comfort all, and do all. Because some people will do that. They want to do everything they possibly can. They're going to help every person they possibly can. We're going to do this over here. And they've completely burnt themselves out on that. And she said she was learning to be quiet and just to rest and be still in the Lord. And that makes a big difference. And I really believe that. So then we move on from prioritize importance to number two, which is don't overcommit. Don't overcommit. That means you learn to say no. You might be good at a whole lot of things. You can't do them all. And even if you try to do them all, usually I always go back to that old saying, you know, he's jack of all trades, but master of none. You know, he can dabble in all of these little things and do a little bit, but he's really not skillful and a master at all of them, just maybe one or two. So we have to look at the skills and abilities that God has given us and focus on using them. It's like, just because a guy can swing a hammer doesn't mean he should be in charge of building a hospital. You know what I mean? So that's not necessary to do that. I know that some people have hearts that really want to be helpful to others. That's good. There's nothing wrong with that. I think God gives us that, that ability to help. You might be the kind of person that likes to be really, really busy or not, but doesn't really matter. You might feel like you're the only one that can do this job and do it right. I've been in that place a few times. I think, oh, my word, just let me do it. You know, because I can get it done. But none of that means that we need to take on every job that comes our way. We can't overcommit, because if we do, we end up with this hectic schedule and we drive ourselves absolutely crazy trying to get it all done. Can't do that. Then our family suffers. Not just we suffer, but our family suffers. Our relationship with God suffers. I mean, who's got time for that? You know what I mean? That's where people are. That's life. So anytime that you're going to take on a new ministry or a new job or a new project or anything else, you have to consider your family. You have to consider your relationships. You have to consider your relationship with God. You have to consider what is most important when you're doing that. And that overcommitment can occur in all kinds of schedules. I'll mention this as well. It's just kind of a sidelight, but sometimes parents get so wrapped up, I think, in vicariously living through their children. They do things like a couple that I knew several years ago put their two boys, who were 2 and 3, in soccer. And they played club soccer all the time. Well, the whole idea was they wanted them to grow up and then play on their high school team and then get into college and play, and they were going to be pro soccer players. They didn't. They didn't even go to college. They did play in high school. But that they ran themselves ragged, going to this boy and then this boy and over here, and they got practice, and then we have games, and one would go to one boy's game, one would go to the other, and those people eventually split up, because that schedule is almost impossible to keep. That's overcommitment. So in family schedules, work schedules, church schedules, school schedules, all of them. And the bottom line, I think I put on there, if you have more on your schedule than you can realistically accomplish in a day, there are probably things on your schedule that God didn't put there. You put them there, or I put them there, but God didn't put them there. And more to the point, he doesn't want them there. Number three, downsize expectations. Downsize expectations. There is nothing more stressful than expecting perfection in a job performance or expecting perfection in your children's behavior. Or expecting perfection in your weight loss, like I'm going to lose 20 pounds this week. Expecting everybody to agree with you about everything that you do and every decision you make or the way you think should be done. We have to set realistic goals and downsize those expectations. Nobody's perfect. There are no perfect scenarios. And again, I know personalities are different. Some people tend to be perfectionists. You know, like they've got their closet lined up and these are all the polo shirts and they're by color. They're color coded all the way down through there. To me, that's perfectionism. If some of you do that, I'm sorry. You just do what you want to do. But they'll drive themselves crazy if it's not like that. So we have to downsize expectations. Number four, we can delegate. All that means is I have this job to do, and I'm going to give you this part of my job to do. That'll take some load off of me. Now, we can obviously you have to pick somebody that can do it, you know, and that you have trust in, but delegate some of your work to someone else. That will help with stress. And the fifth one is similar to that. That's ask for help. I'm not giving you part of my job. I'm just asking you to help me with my job, whatever that might be. My mother-in-law used to say, you know, many hands make light work, and that's true. But they're also depending on personality. Some people are like, well, I did this all on my own, you know, pat themselves on the back. But you have to ask yourself, at what cost did you do that all on your own? What did it cost you in relationships and so forth to do that all on your own? So that brings us then to our relationships. It does not matter whether it's a romantic relationship, if it's a parental one, again, if it's a friend, a boss, coworker, whatever. 44% of Americans identified their relationships as a significant source of stress in their lives. That's almost half. So there are some things we can't control in those relationships. What can we control? What can we do? Now, I know what I've done in the past. And these are things that I'm learning. But what we usually do is fuss and fume over. So somebody did something really stupid, or they said something off the wall, mean, or they were just annoying or whatever. And you're like, oh, get away from me. I mean, that's how we feel. And we'll fuss and fume about that. And I'm not a witty person. I had some students that were extremely witty. I'd say something. They back at me right like that. And I'm like, oh. Wish I could have thought of that. You know, 3 hours later when I'm home fixing dinner, I go, I should have said this. Well, it's a little late at that point. A lot of times we'll react to people and we go home and we'll just fuss and fume over it, you know, and try to figure it out all our own. Or if we do say something, we'll say something we probably shouldn't have said. And then now what am I going to do? Now you got to go back and apologize to people and all of that. And it's a mess. And I think what the Lord has been showing me through the years is this. When we have Jesus in our lives, that should radically change the way we relate to people. I don't see that on Facebook, out of Christian people. I don't see it there. And I'm not on any other social media, so I can't speak to those, but I'm going to guess they're probably all the same. We have to ask ourselves in our relationships, even if this person is annoying, even if he's offended me in some way, he's made me angry or whatever, how do I honor God in this relationship the way I relate to that particular person? Am I exercising the fruits of the Spirit? Or am I reacting with impatience, like, what is your problem? Or disgust, like, I can't believe you did that. Or do you hang out with those kind of people? Or you try to shame someone, or you're insensitive to them, and especially not understanding exactly where they're coming from. Because a lot of times we make judgments, especially as Christians, about other people's behavior and the way they do things when we know absolutely nothing about them up to that point. All we saw was this. We have no idea what they went through and came through all the years before that and what brought them to that area. But a lot of times, instead of praying for them or coming alongside them and trying to be helpful, we'll just kind of sit back and say, well, guess if he wants to go that way, he's just going to fall off the deep end. And, you know, God's not going to honor that. You know, he's going to be in a mess. You know, we say all of these things, but we're not really helpful. So, and I think I wrote down all four of the things that I have in this section. But first of all, we need to pray, and then we need to pray some more, and then we need to pray some more about that relationship, and then rely on God to work. We can stress about it and, excuse me, live in turmoil and so forth, but that's not God's intention. We may be able to resolve things, but nothing is resolved at all if we're only acting in our own wisdom, if you want to call it that, and not consulting the Lord and trying to figure out what should I do in this relationship. That doesn't mean you have to be best friends with somebody. It's an idiot. Okay. Do you understand what I'm saying? That's not it. But relating to the idiot is important. So before you act or speak, we need to pray. Number two, recognize you can't change another person. You can only change yourself. Boy, I have worked and worked and worked on that one. Because I feel like I did this with students. I've done this with my family. It's like, well, if I really, really pray for them, you know, and I do this or whatever, and I treat them this way, then they'll probably make a change. No, they won't. I can't change a person's heart. Only God can do that. I can't change their behavior. They can change their behavior, but they might not. So you have to start asking yourself, then what does God want me to learn in this situation? Or what does he want me to learn from this person? Without going into lots of detail, I want to tell you that I learned some very important things when I was growing up. Because first of all, I had a neglected father who was not at home, divorced my mother when I was in sixth grade. He wasn't around very much, and although he said he loved me, he never showed me love, and I never felt my dad loved me. Never. I, to this day, don't feel like my dad really loved me. Second of all, my mother then married when I was a freshman in high school. She remarried a man that I thought, oh, this is going to be my dad. This is going to be great. It wasn't. He was abusive. I went through those years. She was married to him from the time I was a freshman in high school until I was a senior in college. Those were not good years, and I hated being home. I hated it. But this is what I learned, and it struck me about the time I graduated from college what I learned. I learned what I didn't want in a marriage and what I did want in a marriage. I knew I didn't want to go through what my mother went through. I learned to lean on the Lord to give me a mate. As a matter of fact, I told the Lord, I was rather brash, I guess, but I said, Lord, I'm not getting married. Mm-mm-mm-mm. Not unless you give me somebody, because I'll probably make a mistake like my mom, and I'm not doing it. And I told him that, and I would tell anybody that to this day. I always tell them, God chose my mate for me. I didn't choose. He did. And then he just made it clear to me who that was. I learned to what true unconditional love is, because as I mentioned before, I didn't really feel like my dad loved me, and I never really experienced that. And because of that, I also didn't feel like God loved me, because I wasn't worthy. If I wasn't worthy of my dad's love, why would I be worthy of God's love? So it was very difficult for me, but I did learn what that was. And surprisingly, guess who I learned that through? My husband. And that was the one that God gave to me. I also learned about compassion and understanding about people who live in dysfunctional families. That served me well as a teacher, because the kids in our schools are in messes. The vast majority of them are in a mess. And that's of no making of their own. It's so sad. But you have to have understanding of that when you've got a child or a teenager who's acting like a complete jerk and being disrespectful and all of those things. You have to say, this is what he came from. He either learned this or this is his reaction to his situation, and he doesn't know anything different. So we have to recognize those things in people and recognize we can't change them, but God can. Number three, don't harbor anger about the past. That's kind of the same type of thing. Our reaction to a person and what they did and so forth is more important, basically, than what he did. Our reaction is more important than what he did, because we can't change what he did or what he didn't do. And if we live in that continual anger all the time, we're holding out all the time. And that comes up. And then what are we stressed if we're angry? Yes, we are. Blood pressure goes up, heart beats faster, you know, those kind of things. Like, and this wasn't fair, and why did this happen, and it shouldn't have been this way. But you can't change that. Number four, focus on what you can give rather than what you can get out of a relationship. This is a biggie for me, and I'll tell you why. I taught high school English for years, and there were always, you know, kind of those couples that got together when they were in high school, and some of them married. But I always heard them say things like this. He makes me so happy. I am so happy when I'm with him. And she would say the same thing. Now, there's nothing wrong with being happy. But you and I both know that life is not happy every single day of the year. You are not happy with your significant other every single day of the year. Now, that doesn't mean you're having knockdown, drag-out fights. That's not what I mean. But you know the difference between happiness and joy. You know, you can have joy in a relationship and know this is where I'm supposed to be. But you're not going to agree about everything because you're two different people. And besides that, when you're married, you've got two different genders who don't think alike. Okay? So you can't just say, I'm going into this because this person makes me happy. The same thing is true of a friendship. You know, somebody can say, well, I like to go to lunch with Susan every week because she pays. Or Joe is so much fun to be around. He makes me laugh all the time. Or this is a good one. My mom is always happy to watch my kids every time I need a break. Now, there's nothing wrong with those things, but there's a problem if our expectations of others are not met. So what if Joe shows up one day and he's not making you laugh? Matter of fact, he's kind of in a bummer mood. You know, he's down about something and woe is me. And you're sitting there like, what happened to you? You know, that's not making you happy anymore. Or Susan comes up one day and she says, I can't pay for lunch anymore. You're going to have to take care of your own lunch. Well, that's also a bummer, you know, if you're used to that or whatever. But we can't put expectations on people and expect them to meet. And what we get out of the relationship and think, oh, well, this is what makes us great. Because a lot of times, and I think I put this in your notes as well, but sometimes God has us in relationships, not for what a person can do for us, but for what he can do to them or for them through us. That also will change your thinking. That revolutionizes things when you start thinking, okay, well, this person acted this way and I don't like this, you know, and I prayed about this and I don't know what to do, blah, 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 but I'm going to try to react the way Jesus would have me to. I'm going to try to respond, perhaps is a better word, respond rather than react and so forth, and see what it is that God wants me to do for this person. Number five, communicate honestly, but also speak grace. We should always be honest in our communication with one another, and especially in our relationships. That doesn't necessarily mean that everything that is honest needs to be said. And especially if it can't be said with grace. Because we can use sarcasm. We can use our words to tear people down or to discourage them when they don't really deserve that. And again, I know I use this word often, but it's like, you know, a guy could really be an idiot, but you don't want to look at him and say, you know, you're an idiot. And that's the truth. And the Bible tells me I should be truthful. No. That's not correct. Proverbs 18:21 says, death and life are in the power of the tongue. And I've used this many, many years just with high school students. I said, you all can kill each other or cause life to bloom in another person just with your words. Nothing else, just with your words. Ephesians 4:29, let no corrupt communication, unwholesome words. Again, those would be words that tear down. It doesn't have to be vulgar words. Okay, or that kind of a thing, but just words that tear down and don't build up. Don't let them proceed out of your mouth, but that which is good to the use of edifying or building up, that it may minister grace to the hearers, so that you're saying words that edify in the moment and giving grace to those people. Words are powerful. Words are powerful. What we say matters. The timing of what we say matters. How we say what we say matters. That's our tone. Again, I probably that would be where the sarcasm comes in. I do relate to sarcasm to some degree. But I've always said, if you use sarcasm too much, now you're not believable anymore. It's not funny if you just keep at it, or, you know, keep at it. You might mean it to be funny, or maybe not. But if somebody is continually sarcastic with me, I look at them after a while, and I'm like, okay, did you mean that, or did you not mean that? Because that's what sarcasm does. It casts that doubt. How we say what matters, our tone. It's also possible to say the right thing at the wrong time, or you say it at the right time, but in the wrong way. I know it sounds like a lot of double talk, but all that has to do with our speech. And again, in this day of social media, emails, those kind of things, it's easy for people to say what's on their mind. They don't have to look anybody in the face. You know, there are these keyboard warriors that are just, you know, they're going to rip on you for your politics, for your religion. They don't like the color of your hair. It doesn't matter. But, you know, they're going to speak, but they're not speaking life. They're just speaking death. So the bottom line is we can speak life into everybody we encounter. Our words should be affirming. They should be encouraging, and it should be building up always. When we do that, it will eliminate a lot of stress in many of our relationships. And then, in our finances, we can lessen stress by being diligent in these areas. I'm not sure if I wrote these down or not, but I think I did. Number one, give to God in His work. I'm not going to read through those verses. You see those, and you all understand that this idea of giving to the Lord and to His work and so forth and His people. I do want to mention under here, however, while you're giving, be thankful for what you have. And focus on what you have rather than what you don't have, because discontentment's a major source of financial stress. And I would think probably younger people might experience this more than older ones, but, you know, I don't know that. You don't always know people's financial situations and what they've had, you know, where some of their money has gone and so forth. But for whatever God has given us and whatever we have, and just as Paul said in the New Testament, be content with that. And don't be keep thinking, I got to have this. I want this over here. I want this over here. Just focus on what you have, not what you don't have. I even do that with my grandchildren. Not in anything that has to do with money, but most of my grandchildren don't live here. And we moved here just to be with these four, but we have 15 grandchildren. And they live in Wisconsin and in Georgia, so I don't see them very much. And so I have to tell myself once in a while when I'm feeling sorry for myself, focus on what you have and not what you don't have. You have these four right here. You know, and be happy for that, because I could be living somewhere where I was in Tennessee where I had none of them. Number two, save for the future. This isn't rocket science. You know, some of you probably already have things in place for that, a savings account, a 401k, those kinds of things where you're saving for the future, kind of building a little bit for either unexpected emergencies that may come up where you need some extra money, or when you're retired, those kinds of things. Number three, budget to live. We have to know our expenses and then spend accordingly. What that means is I know what it's going to cost me for my mortgage every month, what the car payment is, those kinds of things, what we're going to spend for utilities, gas, and groceries, and all those essentials. We cannot spend more than we have coming in. I mean, again, that's not rocket science, but when you spend more than you have coming in, or as some people do, and I read about them often, they put it on a card, I'll pay it later. You know, I don't have to pay it all at once. And then they get in trouble and they're in credit card debt that they can't get out of. Sometimes I tell people you might have to eliminate a few extras. I know things are different now than they were 20 years ago, 50 years ago, or whatever. And it, like when my husband and I were first married and so forth, they're different. But you don't have to carry your lunch. I mean, I'm sorry, you don't have to eat out for lunch every day if you're going to work. Good night, take a bologna sandwich in a sack. You know what I mean? But some people, they'll do it every day. They eat out every day. Well, that's an expense, because it costs more to eat out than it does to have something that you have from home. Eat a boiled egg. I don't know. But usually we eat more than we think we need anyway. So, you know, can do that. And the big one is, what are you doing with your morning coffee? I used to, my husband have a Keurig, and I have a Keurig, and people used to say, that's so expensive. Those pods are like 50 cents a piece. And I'm thinking, yeah. I said, but I can make that cup of coffee for 50 cents, and you're buying yours at Starbucks for $5. You know, yeah, or whatever. But I said, to do that every day, that's not wise. So we can all eliminate things. We know what our extras are that we don't really need, we just like. But if we're having financial difficulties, you just eliminate those for a while. We need to live simply within our means. And again, this overlaps a little bit, but don't go into debt for something you can't really afford. Now, that doesn't mean a house, because none of us can buy a house outright, you know, or a car. That's probably not going to happen either. But there are some things, you know, people think they want that they don't really have to have, not right now, and they can't afford it. And again, if they're putting it on the card or putting it on payments or whatever, I sometimes think, do they not teach these things in high school anymore or college? You know, you can put that on that card, and that's great, and that's so easy. You know, just swipe that thing. Now you're just tapping it, you know, or whatever, and there it is. It's so easy. But if they just paid a minimum on that thing, they'll probably pay for that thing three times before they get it paid off. You can't do that. Not if you want to try to get ahead just a little bit. We live in a society of a bigger and better philosophy, too. You know, people want more, and they want it now. They don't want to wait. So, again, I find young people that, you know, I had in school, it's like they want to have what their mom and dad had. Matter of fact, I had a girl tell me one time, she said, I don't want to use my mom's furniture. I sat on that thing for, you know, X amount of years. Like, oh, she's a whole 18 years old. But, you know, I don't want that. I want my own. So they went into debt to get new furniture. I'm thinking, that's unnecessary. Why do that when you really can't afford it, or you have to have something bigger and better? Some people don't need a new car. They just want a new car. Or they have to upgrade their phone. Good night. You see what phones cost these days? Wow. I'm just like, you know, those kinds of things. But why do they have to have that? But they kind of live by that bigger and better philosophy. I had this. Now I want something that's a little bigger and a little better. It's a house, a car, a phone, whatever. It doesn't really matter. But all that does is get you in a place where you're excessively spending for something you really don't need. And then you start getting all this stress, like, how am I going to pay for this? Or what happens over here? Or something else comes up, and now I've got, you know, juggling back and forth. And then start arguing about who's spending how much money and all those kinds of things. A lot of stress involved in that. So we have to think through and plan how we're going to spend or don't spend our money. And then the last point I wanted to make was this. And to me, this is the most important one. But in every area of our lives, especially when the stress is hitting us hard, we have to remember that God is active and sovereign and personal in our lives. Philippians 1:6, he which began a good work in you will perform it till the day of Jesus Christ. I want to mention to you that God is continuously working wisely and powerfully in our lives. Sometimes we forget that. He's always working. And I put the word down continuously. I don't know if you know this, but again, this is my English teacher coming out in me. There's a difference between the word continuously and continually. And most people don't know that, and they'll use them interchangeably. Continually is what happened when you were in high school, for instance. You had a bell ring between classes. You know, English class, bell rings. Math class, bell rings. It's an intermittent going on of that bell. But if the fire bell or the fire alarm went off, it continuously rang. It wasn't intermittent. God works in our lives continuously. It isn't he works here and then another couple of days he'll work again. He's always working every single day to work wisely for us, and he's always present. One of my favorite Christian songs is Waymaker, and it says this: Waymaker, miracle worker, promise keeper, light in the darkness. My God, that is who you are. And even when I don't feel that you're working, and even when I don't see it, you're working. You never stop. You never stop working. That's in every aspect of our lives. So even if you're praying for somebody, like I have somebody on my heart right now that I've been praying for years, and I'm like, Lord, I don't see anything happening. Nothing. But I believe you're working. And every once in a while, I might get a phone call, or I'll get some message or something, and such happened. I thought, see, the Lord's working. I just didn't see it. And sometimes, and I've even said this to people. I said, I may go to my grave and never see the result, but God's working. And I believe that because that's the kind of God he is. Number two, he's sovereign. Nothing takes God by surprise. He's not wringing his hands trying to figure out what he's going to do in situations. He doesn't care a bit about what's going to happen in the election. Okay. It doesn't matter. He is there taking care of all of it. He's not overwhelmed by any circumstance. His resources are not going to run out. His grace does not run out. He is in charge. He is in charge of alone. Doctors are not in charge. Hospitals are not in charge. Educational institutions are not in charge. The church is not in charge. And your pastor is not in charge. God alone is in charge. He is sovereign. When we can look at everything that goes on around us, and even in our country right now, it's a mess, and we know that. And we can get really, I know me, because I tend to be more on the fearful side than other people. And so that's why I don't like to hang around people that are real negative or they're fearful people. Like, get away from me. I don't need that. You know, I need people around me that are building up or whatever. But the verse that I hold too often is that thou will keep him in perfect peace whose mind is stayed on thee. And God will keep us in that point of peace and rest in him as long as we are keeping our focus on him. Also, he is personal. He's not just involved in the world at large and in general, but he's involved in our lives specifically because he loves us and he cares for us and he comes alongside us in trouble. And I think we get to learn every week. You know, we come to church, we go to Bible studies and so forth, and we're learning about God and those kinds of things. But to me, this goes a little deeper than that. It's not just that we know a lot of things about him. It's knowing him. Jeremiah 9:23 says, thus saith the Lord, let not the wise man glory in his wisdom, neither let the mighty man glory in his might, let not the rich man glory in his riches. But let him that glorieth glorying in this, that he understandeth and knoweth me, that I am the Lord, which exercise loving kindness, judgment, and righteousness in the earth. For in these things I delight, saith the Lord. God wants us to know him. We're not going to know him completely. He's God. If we could know him completely, then we would be on his level, correct? But we can know a whole lot more about him and know him in a way that we know one another, if that makes sense. That means actively and intentionally inviting him into every area of our lives, being aware of his presence, resting in his closeness, being in constant fellowship, like that pray without ceasing thing in every moment of the life and talking to him throughout the day. So what that means is, maybe I can only talk from my standpoint, but you know, I get up in the morning, a lot of times I take a walk and I say, Lord, thank you for this day. Now, I am not on my knees when I'm doing it. I'm walking. I pray a lot in my car with my eyes open. Okay? But, you know, those kinds of things. But you thank the Lord for things and talk to him about things during the day. You know, like, Lord, this is like the third time in the last hour I've had to speak to my daughter. You know, because she's doing such and such. La, la, la. You know, help me to have patience. Or I'm really scared about this appointment that's coming up. But I'm talking about an actual communication with the Lord in every aspect of life. There's sometimes I lay down at night and I just lay in my bed and the fan's gone, Dave's sleeping over there snoring, and I'm just like, ah, Lord, thank you for this bed. And some people don't have a nice soft bed to sleep in at night, you know, and I have a fan and there's air conditioning and I'm not sweltering in the South Carolina heat, you know, just things like that. They're little things, but it's a constant fellowship. We don't have to just go to God when something really bad happens. You don't do that probably with your best friend, whether that's your spouse or maybe you've been blessed with two or three really close friends, you know. But my mother told me a long time ago when I asked her, I said, Mom, how do I pray? And I know some people will not agree with this, and that's okay, but this is how I pray. She says, you pray like God is your very best friend. Well, in my mind, when I learned to drive, my very best friend would be sitting beside me in the car, and we'd be talking. And so I did that. I learned to do that as a college student. I talked out loud for a 2.5-hour drive back and forth between home and college every time I came home. It wasn't hard. That's when I prayed a lot about, Lord, I'm not getting married, not unless you give me a husband. And then I would pray for him. I didn't know who he was, but I would say, Lord, I don't know where he is or who he is, but you be with him and help him to grow in you and be the kind of man that you want him to be. And those kinds of things. But that's bringing God in so we're having constant fellowship with him on a daily basis and resting in that. I really believe if we make Jesus the foundation of our lives and we stay in fellowship with him on a daily basis, that's going to eliminate a lot of stress that we have. Because it's like, yeah, well, I don't like what's going on here, but the Lord will take care of it. And that doesn't mean he's going to come down with a big sledgehammer and hit him on the head. But the Lord will take care of it, whether it's something that we foolishly, you know, kind of created on our own, or if it's something beyond our control. Philippians 4, 6, and 7 says, be careful for nothing. I take that as don't be stressed for anything, but in everything, by prayer and supplication with thanksgiving, let your requests be made known unto God. And the peace of God, which passeth all understanding, shall keep your hearts and minds through Christ Jesus. So what we do with the stress in our lives is going to make all the difference between our being frazzled and burnout, or our maintaining peace and calm and resting in Jesus.